all the best Bitcoin works read aloud so that you can listen. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. What is up, guys? Welcome back to the Cryptoconomy. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. We are jumping back in. We're going to start off our week. We're going back to the Gradually Then Suddenly series and reading Bitcoin is Not a Pyramid Scheme. This is one of the ones that we skipped to get to the most recent one, Bitcoin Obsoletes All Other Money. The only other thing that I want to mention before we jump in, I have finally gotten to the end of a couple of projects that I've been working on, so I'm ready to announce those here in the next couple of days. So don't forget to subscribe and stay tuned for that. Follow me on Twitter. But without further ado, let's go ahead and jump into the next of the Gradually Then Suddenly series by Parker Lewis on the Unchained Capital blog, titled Bitcoin is Not a Pyramid Scheme. A few years ago, I received an email from a friend asking for my opinion about an investment opportunity that a mutual contact of ours was considering. After a quick search on the internet and after having watched a few videos, I explained that it looked like a pyramid scheme. This was my shorthand for avoid at all cost. The information was forwarded along to our mutual contact, and the reply back was not what I was expecting. Are all pyramid schemes bad? Some pyramid schemes are harder to identify than others, but even those that are easy to identify find prey in unassuming victims. A good rule of thumb is to run, not walk, away from anything that even hints of being a pyramid scheme. Thankfully, Bitcoin is not one of them. While it may seem obvious, not everyone understands what a pyramid scheme actually is, what the warning signs may be, or why such schemes always fail. Definition of a pyramid scheme, Securities and Exchange Commission. In the classic pyramid scheme, participants attempt to make money solely by recruiting new participants into the program. The hallmark of these schemes is the promise of sky-high returns in a short period of time for doing nothing other than handing over your money and getting others to do the same. The fraudsters behind a pyramid scheme may go to great lengths to make the program look like a legitimate multi-level marketing or MLM program. But despite their claims to have legitimate products or services to sell, these fraudsters simply use money coming in from new recruits to pay off early-stage investors. U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Warning signs of a pyramid scheme. From the Federal Trade Commission. Promoters make extravagant promises about your earning potential. Stop. Such promises are false. Promoters emphasize recruiting new distributors for your sales network as the real way to make money. Walk away. In a legitimate MLM program, you should be able to make money just by selling the product. Promoters play on your emotions or use high-pressure sales tactics, maybe saying you'll lose the opportunity if you don't act now, and discouraging you from taking time to study the company. Leave by the nearest exit. Any company that tries to pressure you to join is one to avoid. Distributors buy more products than they want to use or can resell, just to stay active in the company or to qualify for bonuses or other rewards. If you see this happening, keep your money. Not all multi-level marketing programs are pyramid schemes, but all pyramid schemes are in some fashion a multi-level marketing program. With pyramid schemes, there is always some company, and it is selling a product for which the end demand falls far short of the available supply. The company recruits participants to purchase inventory and to recruit new participants. The participants are all salespeople, and compensation is tied mostly to recruiting rather than to selling the actual product. Often the sale of the product is purposefully woven into the recruitment process. In a normal sales-driven business, the company takes on the inventory risk and pays commissions based on sales to end users. In a pyramid scheme, the salespeople take on the inventory risk rather than the company, and compensation is paid for recruiting more salespeople and selling product through to new participants. It all falls apart because sufficient in demand for the product does not actually exist. Everyone up the chain can make money at the expense of the new recruits at the end of the line. This is a pyramid scheme. Bitcoin is not. Bitcoin is not a company. It has no employees and its supply is finitely scarce. No matter how many people adopt it, there will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin. The distinctions should be glaringly obvious, but because Bitcoin is complex and the very idea of money is not well understood, it can easily be confused. Bitcoin will only become a global reserve currency if hundreds of millions, if not billions, more adopt it. And seemingly everyone that goes down the Bitcoin rabbit hole ends up on the other side explaining it to their family and friends, pitching it as a better form of money. Sounds kind of like a pyramid scheme, right? Wrong. When Dell started selling PCs on its website in 1996 and everyone told their friends to get a Dell, was it a pyramid scheme? When Apple released the first iPhone in 2007 and everyone told their friends to drop the BlackBerry for its superior successor, was it a pyramid scheme? Technological shifts often happen fast. 10 and 20 years later, smartphones and PCs are ubiquitous. It is all about the quality of the product and the incentive structure. If someone owned Apple stock or Dell stock, did it change the fact that the product itself provided a real value proposition? Was there a direct benefit for telling people about a new technological innovation? The value proposition of an innovation trumps all else. It does not matter how you learn about it. All that matters is whether the innovation provides utility. If it does, people will want to use it. If it doesn't, they won't. That is what makes a market. The utility and innovation of Bitcoin. Bitcoin's utility is as money. It has a market because it solves a problem inherent to modern money. Not only is Bitcoin not a pyramid scheme, it is fundamentally distinct from the class of innovation that could be offered by any individual company. Bitcoin is not Dell, and it is not Apple. It is not a tech stock. There is no company that exists behind Bitcoin. Bitcoin is not a company selling a product, and there is no income stream to pay future dividends. Bitcoin is not about making money. Instead, Bitcoin is money. Or at least it has become money to those choosing to store a portion of their wealth in it. And it's not a get-rich-quick scheme. It is fundamentally about storing the value you have already created. Bitcoin is a bearer asset. However, unlike a bearer bond, there is no income stream. Bitcoin's innovation is that it represents a superior form of money. But there are no future promises beyond being in possession of a digital bearer instrument. The only utility of Bitcoin is in holding it as a currency and transacting with it in the future, whether that be in exchange for legacy currencies or other goods and services. Bitcoin is only useful as a form of money, and it will only maintain value if others demand it in the future. But this is true of any form of money, not just Bitcoin. Money is not a collective hallucination or merely a belief system. Monetary goods have distinct properties which make them more or less effective in facilitating exchange. However, monetary properties are not absolute. The relative strength of monetary properties is the fundamental basis of demand. When the market evaluates Bitcoin, it does so relative to other monetary mediums, the dollar, euro, yen, gold, etc. The supply of Bitcoin and its rigid supply constraint is the foundation of Bitcoin's utility and fundamental demand. It is also why Bitcoin is not a pyramid scheme. There will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin. That is Bitcoin's selling point. Everyone knows it. Everyone remembers it. Everyone can also verify it at any point in time. For discussion of how and why Bitcoin has a credibly fixed supply, See, Bitcoin, not blockchain, and Bitcoin is not backed by nothing. But for now, just work on the assumption that the supply of Bitcoin is capped at 21 million. In contrast, no one knows the supply of dollars. The Fed estimates the current supply of dollars, but no one knows how many dollars will exist in the future. There is no constraint on the supply of the dollar other than the Federal Reserve, and all we know for sure is that many more dollars will exist in the future. It is a limitless function. In the end, there is fundamental demand for Bitcoin because its monetary policy is 1. Optimally engineered, and 2. Credibly enforced. Relative to its competition, Bitcoin is a vastly superior monetary medium. The monetary base in fiat systems changes unpredictably, whereas the monetary base in Bitcoin is governed by a well-defined supply schedule. Think about the monetary base as setting the foundation of a global economic system. The unpredictable changes in the supply of dollars is not merely akin to shifting the proverbial goalposts. Instead, it is more similar to building the field on a 1980s-style waterbed and then shifting the goalposts. The entire game is distorted, not just the endpoints. Bitcoin, on the other hand, is a bedrock as a function of its fixed supply, and over time, the foundation becomes stronger and stronger. The credibility of its supply schedule is reinforced with each passing Bitcoin block. As it becomes more evident that Bitcoin's supply schedule is credibly enforced, more people adopt Bitcoin as a form of money, and those that already have increasingly use it as a store of wealth. Fixed supply plus increasing adoption equals increased value. As adoption increases and as value rises, Bitcoin becomes further decentralized. And as Bitcoin decentralizes over time, it becomes harder to change, reinforcing the credibility of its foundation, its fixed supply. You are the scammer. In a pyramid scheme, the people selling the scheme are the scammers. These scammers are selling the promise of future monetary gains through high-pressure sales tactics and by recruiting new members to the scheme as the primary compensation mechanism. In Bitcoin, the people buying Bitcoin are the scammers, as described in Michael Goldstein's timeless piece, Everyone's a Scammer. If this is you, you are the scammer. In most cases today, whenever someone buys Bitcoin, they are directly trading a fractionally reserved form of currency with the promise of future debasement in return for a bearer asset with a finite supply and a vastly superior monetary policy. The person on the other end of the line is getting the raw deal. It is not to say that literally everyone that sells a Bitcoin does so without good reason. It is money, after all, and its utility is in exchange. By definition, market participants have a wide variety of present needs for liquidity, and real value is transferred every time a Bitcoin is transacted, whether for dollars or for goods and services. However, on average and over the longer term, it is information asymmetry in full effect. Bitcoin's monetary policy is optimally engineered and credibly enforced, though few understand it, which is why it represents the greatest asymmetry in the world today. A chart comparing Bitcoin's properties to the dollar. Supply. Bitcoin has a fixed supply of 21 million. The dollar has limitless QE. Supply schedule. Bitcoin has a fixed schedule with 10-minute intervals. The dollar has an unpredictable QE and reverse QE schedule. Governance. Bitcoin is by consensus. The dollar is by central bank. Monetary first principles. A monetary medium with the lowest rate of change is most effective in communicating economic signals, and a fixed supply, a zero rate of change, is the optimal monetary policy endgame. While the monoculture that is modern mainstream academia disagrees with this view, a fixed supply currency is superior to a currency that increases in supply over time and at unpredictable rates. In any economy, supply and demand for goods and services, relative to the supply and demand of money, dictates prices. Prices is what ultimately coordinates economic activity, and money is the foundation of the pricing mechanism within an economy. A currency with a fixed supply would remove the noise created by changes to the money supply in the price system, thus creating more reliable market signals. Because a monetary good facilitates the exchange between goods used for the purpose of either consumption or production, the form of money with the lowest rate of change will most accurately reflect changes in supply and demand of all other goods. Essentially, money is used to communicate the relative value of other goods and services, and changes in the money supply distort the communication of this information by introducing an extraneous variable to the equation. For example, an iPhone costs approximately $1,000, whereas a barrel of oil costs approximately $50. The information communicated through a monetary medium is that an iPhone costs approximately 20 times more than a barrel of oil. Money communicates opportunity cost, economic trade-offs, through its price system. And the more constant the quantity of money, the lower rate of change, the more reliable the communication of information and economic trade-offs. If the money supply increased by 10% and prices adjusted equally, an iPhone would cost $1,100 and a barrel of oil would cost $55. An iPhone would still cost 20 times more than a barrel of oil, and that is the relevant information which all market participants rely upon. In the real world, the problem is that prices do not adjust equally as the money supply changes. Instead, price signals become distorted. In a world with a constant money supply, changes in price would more accurately reflect changes in supply and demand in underlying markets for goods and services, rather than also reflecting the unequal impact of a changing money supply. Changes in the money supply create noise extraneous to the underlying economic activity. Price coordinates economic trade-offs, and the reliability of a pricing system is dependent on the stability of the form of money used to communicate information. Quote, "We must look at the price system as such a mechanism for communicating information if we want to understand its real function. A function which, of course, it fulfills less perfectly as prices grow more rigid. Even when quoted prices have become quite rigid, however, the forces which would operate through changes in price still operate to a considerable extent through changes in the other terms of the contract. The most significant fact about this system is the economy of knowledge with which it operates, or how little the individual participants need to know in order to be able to make the right action. In abbreviated form, by a kind of symbol, only the most essential information is passed on, and passed on only to those concerned. It is more than a metaphor to describe the price system as a kind of machinery for registering change, or a system of telecommunications which enables individual producers to watch merely the movement of a few pointers, as an engineer might watch the hands of a few dials, in order to adjust their activities to changes of which they may never know more than is reflected in the price movement." End quote. Hayek, The Use of Knowledge in Society. In that regard, monetary goods are differentiated, at least those that emerge on the free market. It is why money is an effective communication tool. The market structure for money is different than that of all other goods. A consumption good is consumed, and a production good is ultimately consumed in the production of other consumption goods. Whereas the utility of money is in exchange. It is functional in the coordination of trade by and between consumption and production goods, rather than being consumed itself. Because the utility of money is in exchange, scarcity is more important than the nominal amount of money in an economy. As demand for money increases and as its price rises, there is not a commensurate supply response because of natural supply constraints. The same is not true for any individual good or service. The relative supply constraint of money is what allows it to communicate relative value between other goods and services. Consumption goods and production goods can be substituted for each other, but money facilitates virtually all exchange between all other goods. The value of a money may fluctuate relative to goods and services, but relative scarcity of a money supply allows price to be communicated in terms of the money itself. Prior to Bitcoin, no form of money was finitely scarce. Bitcoin has a fixed supply capped at 21 million. Finite scarcity creates a constant where none existed previously. Imagine the supply of one good being perfectly constant while the supply of all other goods fluctuates. Demand for all goods changes, but only one constant exists, the supply of Bitcoin. In this world, everything would be measured against the constant. The purchasing power of money would communicate far more perfect information through this pricing mechanism than if the supply of money itself were changing. By creating one constant, everything else can be more reliably measured. And the desired information is not the absolute value of any one good. All value is subjective. Instead, the critical information communicated through a pricing mechanism is the relative value or relative price of many goods to each other. While price levels are ever-changing due to constantly shifting supply and demand, the stability of the pricing mechanism itself allows for economic coordination via the communication of opportunity cost. In other words, how we know or learn that an iPhone costs approximately 20 times more than a barrel of oil. Distortion of the price system. All right, we're about halfway through this piece, but let's go ahead and take a break here. I need to stand up and stretch my legs for a minute. I may or may not have, this is a long piece, but there's so much other great stuff coming. So let's go ahead and hit our sponsor, and then hopefully I'll have a little bit of time for commentary afterward. Distortion of the price system. In our current system, the supply of money changes unpredictably and increases over time. This is core to the central banking monetary model, and it derives from monetarist economic theory, which argues that an active management of the money supply stimulates aggregate demand and ultimately promotes full employment. What it technically does is manipulate interest rates downward by increasing the supply of money. Lower interest rates increase the willingness and incentive to borrow. However, all else being equal, a lower interest would otherwise decrease the willingness to lend. Essentially, by inflating the money supply, the central bank artificially manipulates the function of credit, creating a sustained imbalance between the incentive to borrow and the willingness to lend. The more pervasive consequence is the distortion of the pricing mechanism that coordinates economic activity. By manipulating the supply of money and the supply of credit, central banks distort all prices throughout the market. False signals and bad information are distributed to all market participants. The entire supply and demand structure of the economy becomes distorted as hundreds of millions of people respond to manipulated price signals, and when resources within the economy are reallocated based on those signals. When the money supply is increased, new money and credit enters the system through various channels and at unpredictable times. The quantity and rate of change is unknown to most market participants. Instead, market participants react to price signals. That is how information is communicated. A price signal may be the cost of a good at the supermarket or it may be a salary an employer is willing to pay for a certain job. The change in the money supply creates a distortion of prices such that market participants cannot effectively understand whether changes in price are driven by changes in underlying supply and demand structures, or to what extent changes in price are merely a function of more or less money in the system. Regardless, everyone reacts to distorted signals. For a more tangible example, the Fed purchased $1.7 trillion of mortgage-backed securities, 17% of all mortgages, following the financial crisis as part of its quantitative easing program, which ultimately increased the base money supply by $3.6 trillion. Most people recall that prior to the financial crisis, there was a housing bubble. By directly purchasing mortgages and by inflating the money supply, the Fed manipulated interest rates lower. Housing relies heavily on the supply of credit and ultimately on the cost of interest. With lower interest rates and more money available to lend, housing prices were manipulated higher. As a result, distorted price signals were sent to both buyers and sellers. Developers of housing respond by building more homes, increasing supply, and buyers of homes believe they can take on more debt at lower rates to purchase homes. More resources in the economy are devoted to the function of housing because of higher price levels. However, any increase in demand can only be sustained so long as the cost of credit is continually manipulated downward as a function of an increasing money supply. Despite wide recognition of the unsustainable housing bubble in 2007, the National Home Price Index is now 15% higher than it was at the prior peak. This is the manipulation of price levels on full display, and it happens as an intended function of central bank monetary policy. The Fed increases the money supply, lowers interest rates, and inflates asset prices such that the amount of existing debt in the credit system can be sustained. Credit expansion is the Fed's objective in stimulating growth, and net new credit cannot be created unless existing debt levels can be sustained, which is why the Fed must inflate asset prices to achieve its objectives. Asset prices support existing debt levels. When everyone figures out that the price signals are unsustainable and unreliable, it causes a shock to the system. This is what happened in 2007, and it is likely to happen again as the market signals have become even further distorted. But it is not some evil scheme. The Fed is not a purposely malicious actor. The Fed ultimately intends to promote full employment through its policies. But what it actually does is manipulate relative price signals, which creates imbalances in the underlying supply and demand structures of the economy, creating sudden and more chronic unemployment. Hayek spoke on this subject in his 1974 Nobel Prize-winning speech, The Pretense of Knowledge. As a function of manipulated prices, more resources are devoted to a segment of the economy than could otherwise be sustained naturally. When the central bank changes the course of its monetary policy, prices begin to respond and the market corrects. Because price levels have been manipulated on a sustained basis, a demand shock becomes inevitable, and everyone figures out imbalances exist. In the case of the housing example, supply, both goods and labor, significantly exceeds sustainable demand at current price levels. More broadly, imbalances are everywhere. It becomes apparent that supply and demand are significantly out of balance and unemployment increases rapidly. The market cannot find an equilibrium because all markets have been manipulated on a sustained basis for extended periods of time. Quote, in fact, in the case discussed, the very measures which the dominant macroeconomic theory has recommended as a remedy for unemployment, namely the increase of aggregate demand, have become a cause of a very extensive misallocation of resources, which is likely to make later large-scale unemployment inevitable. The continuous injection of additional amounts of money at points of the economic system, where it creates a temporary demand which must cease when the increase of the quantity of money stops or slows down, together with the expectation of a continuing rise of prices, draws labor and other resources into which can last only so long as the increase of the quantity of money continues at the same rate, or perhaps even only so long as it continues to accelerate at a given rate. What this policy has produced is not so much a level of employment that could not have been brought about in other ways, as a distribution of employment which cannot be indefinitely maintained and which after some time can be maintained only by a rate of inflation which would rapidly lead to a disorganization of all economic activity. The fact is that by a mistaken theoretical view, we have been led into a precarious position in which we cannot prevent substantial unemployment from reappearing. Not because, as this view is sometimes misrepresented, this unemployment is deliberately brought about as a means to combat inflation, but because it is now bound to occur as a deeply regrettable but inescapable consequence of the mistaken policies of the past as soon as inflation ceases to accelerate. End quote. Hayek, The Pretense of Knowledge. This is what occurred during and in the aftermath of the financial crisis. It was the boiling over point after the Fed had manipulated the supply of money and the supply of credit for decades. As portrayed in The Big Short, the financial crisis often gets blamed on the subprime crisis, but the not often discussed 800-pound gorilla in the room is central bank monetary policy. Following the crisis, the Fed responded by pursuing the same policy action it had pursued for decades, but on a much greater scale. It massively increased the money supply, further manipulating price signals. When the money supply is manipulated, recognize that not all price levels respond ratably. Money enters the system through different channels, and the expansion of credit impacts certain segments of the economy more than others. All prices are manipulated, but not equally. It is fundamentally the distortion of relative prices which disrupt the underlying supply and demand function of a market. Price communicates information. It is how market participants communicate what they value on a relative basis. And it is how all market participants then respond to those preferences on the supply side. What skills people train themselves with. What businesses people choose to build. What employment opportunities people seek. The Fed may not intend to do harm by manipulating the money supply, but ultimately it is the unavoidable consequence of distorting the price mechanism within an economy. Predictability of the money supply. Bitcoin is the white knight, or at least it has the potential to be. By creating a fixed supply, Bitcoin has the potential to be the greatest pricing mechanism the world has ever known. Once Bitcoin reaches its maximum supply of 21 million, changes to the money supply will be removed entirely from the equation of price signals. It should be axiomatic that the creation of money does nothing to generate real economic activity. It doesn't matter whether the change in the money supply is predictably small or whether the money supply increases significantly and unpredictably. Printing money does nothing to generate economic activity. It only serves to distort supply and demand. The utility of money is in exchange. Whether present exchange or future exchange, that is all. Money is not consumed. It is used to coordinate the economic activity that allows for capital to be accumulated. Whether it be physical capital required to produce real goods or human capital which advances arts, science, mathematics, etc., that capital is the true savings of a society. And it is fundamental to the function of an economy. Most people think of savings in monetary terms because money is a unit of account, but real savings is represented by the accumulated capital that enriches the lives of individuals, families, and communities. In a world with a fixed money supply, monetary savings would be constant. Money would transfer from individual to individual, family to family, or business to business, but in total, the money supply would neither increase nor decrease. Economic activity would be coordinated as a function of money and with an undistorted pricing mechanism. The aggregate preferences of all markets would be more accurately communicated without the distortion of a changing money supply. Imbalances in supply and demand would be naturally corrected and not sustained over long periods of time. As a consequence, imbalances would also be smaller and not systemic to the economy as a whole. It does not mean all prices would always be perfect or that other variables such as government spending or taxes could not influence or distort economic activity. However, it would eliminate the primary mechanism that distorts price signals and market structures. Bitcoin's fixed supply is the foundation of its more reliable pricing system, but it is also issued at a predictable rate. In the future state, when Bitcoin reaches its maximum supply, the rate of change thereafter will be zero. But on its way to that future state, Bitcoin embeds a stable and predictable supply schedule, which is a distinct and equally important part of the equation. Bitcoin are issued through a mining process that helps to secure the network, and the network adjusts to ensure that Bitcoin are issued on average every 10 minutes. If more mining resources are added to the network adjusts to prevent Bitcoin from being issued at a faster rate. More mining results in greater levels of network security, rather than increasing the rate of issuance or increasing the total amount of Bitcoin that will ultimately be issued. This allows the entire economic system to plan for the future. It allows miners building security infrastructure to forecast future compensation. But it also allows all market participants to predictably know the rate of change of the currency at any point in time. Rather than allowing Bitcoin to be issued rapidly or at an unpredictable rate, the network ensures that Bitcoin will be issued steadily over time and as a consequence, on a more distributed basis. Most importantly, it constantly reinforces the credibility of the overall issuance structure. Every 10 minutes, on average, a certain number of Bitcoin are issued. Approximately every 4 years, that number is cut in half until ultimately no incremental Bitcoin will be issued. On the path to 21 million, the enforcement of the fixed supply every 10 minutes builds credibility in the future state supply over time. All market participants come to understand that the fixed supply will be enforced not because of a magical point in time when the maximum is actually reached, but instead because the network enforces its monetary policy every 10 minutes. By creating a predictable supply schedule, the rate of change predictably decreases, and all market participants can observe for themselves that the system is functioning as intended. Monetary policy by consensus versus central bank. This process, which constantly reinforces the credibility of Bitcoin's monetary system, is occurring in parallel to the dysfunction of the legacy monetary systems. Central banks everywhere are increasing the money supply of their relative economies at unpredictable rates. As discussed previously, the Fed increased the money supply in the U.S. by $3.6 trillion following the financial crisis, from 2008 to 2014. Despite the Fed forecasting its plans, no one knew what the total would ultimately be. Everyone was guessing. The Fed didn't even know. And after increasing the money supply by several multiples, the Fed then began removing $50 billion from the economy each month, a process which began in October of 2017. Again, no one knew exactly how much money would actually be removed from the system, in total, or for how long. In aggregate, approximately $700 billion in base money was removed over the course of approximately 2 years. And now, as of October 2019, the Fed has once again shifted course and has begun to add more money back into the system. Just recently, the Fed signaled plans to add $60 billion to the financial system each month, planned for the next 6 months. But once again, no one really knows for how long this will go on or whether the amounts will change. Realistically, the Fed does not know because it is impossible to know. All we practically know is that from this point forward, the money supply will increase, and by a lot. But recognize, most market participants have no idea any of this has occurred or is occurring. All market participants really know is what is communicated to them via prices and employment opportunities. Those that have an understanding of the Fed's actions may be in a better position to forecast or predict the directional consequences, but economic systems are complex. We all react to the pricing mechanisms around us, and no one has anywhere close to perfect knowledge. This is the pretense of knowledge. The aggregate knowledge of millions of people is communicated through price, which is ultimately a function of ever-changing preferences of the individuals that make up an economy. Individuals are inherently limited in the knowledge they possess, and this is certainly true of central banks. In the central banking monetary model, 12 individuals or thereabout determine how and when to create billions, if not trillions, of dollars, despite possessing inherently limited knowledge. No matter how well-intentioned or how much knowledge possessed, the net consequence is the distortion of the fundamental mechanism, i.e. the pricing mechanism, which aggregates knowledge possessed by the market as a whole. For everyone relying upon the dollar as a unit of account and as a mechanism to create economic trade-offs, the very foundation changes unpredictably, unbeknownst to most of its participants. Distorted price signals are communicated gradually through millions of markets, impacting the decisions made by hundreds of millions, and the centralized mechanism that dictates monetary policy is the root cause of the distortion. And even if a reasonable person believed active money supply management to be a net benefit, Bitcoin is now operating alongside the legacy economic system, a decentralized system versus a centralized system, monetary policy by consensus versus monetary policy by central bank. While the money supply of the legacy system is unpredictably changing, the Bitcoin network is operating flawlessly with a known supply and with a predictable rate of change. Rather than it being a philosophical or economic debate, there are now two competing systems, and the market will have the last say. While Bitcoin may be complicated and the very subject of money may not be well understood, the flaws in the existing system are independent of Bitcoin. The $17 trillion of negative-yielding debt should be evidence enough, and it only exists as a direct consequence of central bank monetary policy. Ultimately, the currencies that support the legacy system will be the release valve, because central banks will be forced to increase the money supply in order to sustain what is an otherwise unsustainable credit system. With the legacy system coordinated by central banks, all one can rely on is that the money supply will change and at unpredictable rates. With Bitcoin, everyone can verify the supply and the predictable rate of change. By running a Bitcoin full node, anyone can verify the number of valid Bitcoin that exist in circulation and the amount of new Bitcoin issued in each block. Anyone and everyone can verify this information without trusting anyone else. This is how Bitcoin works. Each node not only verifies information, it also validates information independently. Bitcoin's monetary supply is enforced on a decentralized basis by all nodes within the network. With precision, everyone can calculate when future blocks will be solved and when the rate of issuance will change. The fact that everyone can verify and validate the money supply, regardless of the nominal amount, reinforces the credibility of the monetary system. This reinforcement occurs every 10 minutes, 6 times an hour, 144 times a day, 4,320 times a month, 52,560 times a year, with each passing Bitcoin block. The monetary system hardens as market participants validate that the monetary policy is enforced over and over again, every 10 minutes. A fixed supply is of little meaning without the credibility of its enforcement. Anyone can copy Bitcoin's architecture and code base, but what cannot be replicated is the credibility of its monetary properties. The consensus mechanism which governs Bitcoin is the foundation of its credibility and what ultimately sets Bitcoin apart from its competition. Even if an individual remained unconvinced that a currency with a fixed supply would communicate better information through its pricing mechanism, it does not matter what any individual believes. Bitcoin entrusts its monetary policy to a consensus mechanism. While the Bitcoin supply is practically capped at 21 million, the supply is ultimately governed by a consensus of those that hold Bitcoin as a currency. If the market, which unquestionably possesses more information than any individual, collectively determined that it would be better to change the supply schedule rather than implementing a fixed cap, it is theoretically possible. However, the market would have to come to an overwhelming consensus to effect that change, and practically speaking, a decentralized network of rational economic actors would not form an overwhelming consensus to debase its own currency. Bitcoin's monetary policy is flexible enough to change, but it is impossible to do so without an overwhelming consensus. Bitcoin ultimately represents the contrast between monetary policy by consensus and monetary policy by central bank. The information possessed by a market consensus mechanism will always exceed that of a small number of individuals, which is why Bitcoin outcompetes the legacy system at every step. Bitcoin is not a pyramid scheme. So, no, Bitcoin is not a pyramid scheme. It is not organized by a sketchy company pushing high-pressure sales tactics. It is not peddling some inferior consumer good with abundant supply where compensation is directly tied to recruiting new members to the scheme. Bitcoin is money, and its supply is finitely scarce. It does not matter how many people adopt Bitcoin. As adoption increases, the same pie is distributed across more and more people, and on average, more people control a smaller and smaller share of the network. Its value increases as a function of adoption, and adoption is increasing because its monetary properties are superior to the competition. Bitcoin has a fixed supply. Its supply schedule is predictable, and its monetary policy is governed and enforced by consensus. Bitcoin's pricing mechanism is unmanipulable and cannot be distorted because of its fixed supply. Everything changes around Bitcoin, but Bitcoin's fixed supply is the constant. Because Bitcoin's supply is fixed and cannot be manipulated, it will eventually become the most reliable pricing mechanism in the world, and consequently, the greatest distribution system of knowledge. That is the promise which Bitcoin provides, and it will only proliferate if it creates utility for those that adopt it. Today and into the future, that utility will continue to be the ability to reliably store wealth in a monetary medium that cannot be debased. When people make the claim that Bitcoin could be bigger than the internet, it is generally not a linear application, but instead rooted in the idea that a sovereign, unmanipulable form of money has the potential to be one of the greatest instruments of freedom ever invented. The success of Bitcoin is not a given, but if successful in delivering on its promise, it will facilitate more effective and more peaceable coordination by and amongst people throughout the world. At the end of the day, Bitcoin is a communication tool. That is the function of money. Bitcoin simply provides an alternative system operating on a decentralized basis which no one controls. It is the lack of control and the lack of conscious direction which will allow Bitcoin to accumulate and communicate knowledge more effectively than any pre-existing monetary medium. Current volatility is nothing more than the logical path of price discovery. As adoption increases exponentially over time, and as we advance toward that future state of full adoption. Quote, many of the greatest things man has achieved are the result not of consciously directed thought, and still less the product of a deliberately coordinated effort of many individuals, but of a process in which the individual plays a part which he can never fully understand. They are greater than any individual, because they result from the combination of knowledge, more extensive than a single mind can master. End quote. Hayek, The Counter-Revolution of Science. Next week, Bitcoin cannot be banned. Views presented are expressly my own and not those of Unchained Capital or my colleagues. Thanks to Phil and Adam for reviewing and for providing valuable feedback. Boom! That will conclude Bitcoin is Not a Pyramid Scheme by Parker Lewis, part of the Gradually Then Suddenly series, and of course on the Unchained Capital blog. Okay, I need another break. I need to get away from this for another minute. I think we're at 50 minutes already. This has been an extended one, but I love this piece and there's so much to unpack. I don't have much time for commentary, but I refuse to say nothing about it. We're going to come back in just a minute and we will talk about, we'll get Guy's take on this piece. This podcast has been a passion project of mine for a couple of years now and has continued to grow in a way I had not really expected. Right now, we're right around 430,000 downloads and at about 40,000 or more a month now, only about 2 months away from 500,000. I think there's a huge opportunity here that is not being utilized. If you would like to sponsor this show and get your message out to the audience and help keep this project alive, shoot me a message at sponsor@thecryptoeconomy.com. Now, with that said, if you're selling a shitcoin or some obscure exchange that requires a pointless token or a private pump and dump group, please save both of our time and my inbox and do not send me anything. But if you are a respectable Bitcoin-related service or company that wants to share what they've built, I'd love to hear about it and share it with my audience. Again, you can contact me at sponsor@thecryptoeconomy.com and we can start a conversation and see if your product or service would make a good fit for the Cryptoeconomy crew. Thanks, guys. So, I don't know if this was a shock to anybody else, but he lays out a pretty good argument that Bitcoin is in fact not a pyramid scheme. I did not see that coming. I don't know. See, Bitcoin really suffers from an image problem. And it kind of sucks that people like myself are so evangelical about it that like I see such incredible potential in it that I can't not. It's really difficult to not sound like a lunatic or a salesman when I'm talking about it. I mean, I just get so excited. And because of that, you have to make the choice to give it some time, like to devote some time. The first thing you have to invest in Bitcoin is time to figure out what it is, how to hold it, is it something real versus is it a pyramid scheme? And when, you become kind of averse to just the idea of someone trying to sell you something and the very salesman-y tactic, that first investment isn't made. And that's why I think really is just kind of the general sentiment that I would get in response and the reluctance. Kind of coming to terms with how outside of the Overton window of the normal individual Bitcoin was. in the early years got me to pull back a lot on telling other people about it. And I don't push it at all anymore, but I also do work it in any way that I think it's relevant or where I think there is any interest from the person, like from a philosophical perspective, from the person that I'm talking to. And that's one of the beautiful things about Bitcoin is that it is so multidisciplinary. That if there's any discussion of economics, if there's any discussion of, you know, protests and in the context of liberty and trying to get like Hong Kong, like all these freedom of speech issues that we see all over the place, I think there are a lot of different ways in which Bitcoin plays an important role in all of these things, these huge global macroeconomic and macro political movements and shifts that are happening in the world. Bitcoin is a major player in all of this, so it is very relevant in a lot of, general discussion about what's going on in the world. But I don't push it anymore as this end-all, be-all solution. I lay a seed, put the name out there and just make it present, essentially, and let them be interested in it if they want to be. But just like the fact that I turn away from anybody who's trying to sell me on like becoming a salesman, like I really like his breakdown of how it was really the SEC definition, but Parker Lewis does a good job of breaking it apart and kind of detailing it out, that the real thing being sold from a pyramid scheme is that you are a salesman, you selling more salesmen, adding to the sales team, and that you have to take, as the salesman, you're the one taking the risk on inventory. You're the one taking the risk on then selling it to other people rather than the company. The company and all of the people in the hierarchy above you are just getting paid because you participated, whether or not you actually add any productive value that's relevant. They already make money from you. And the last thing I want is for Bitcoin to be associated with that, because it could not be further from that in the context of what it is. It's so, if you learn anything about it, it's so obviously not a pyramid scheme, but it's hard to define that. If all your association with it is it like all these people are trying to sell me on it, and they insist that I buy it or look into it even when I don't show interest, well, then what else would someone think, you know? Like in a very cursory glance and seeing only that side of it, that's kind of what I would expect the outcome to be perfectly honest. So because of that, the one thing, like I don't really care if they get into it. I would love for them to be interested in it like I am, like when I'm talking to people. But I've found a better longer term strategy, and something that I think leads to them discovering it, allows them to ask the questions, is setting a seed, is just laying out there a question or some very intriguing aspect of Bitcoin, or of like what it enables. For example, like if censorship in China comes up, or Hong Kong, like I always inevitably bring up that, you know, thank God that there are tools like Bitcoin that China does not have the power to censor or stop, that these people can take advantage of. And maybe it's still not widely known to them, but there are some people taking advantage of it. And it's one of the few things that doesn't have to worry about the Great Firewall of China, that can get across that blockade, if you will. If financial corruption or the financial system and Wall Street and all the stock market and the bailouts, if those come up into a conversation, I explain why I think all of that is going the way of the dinosaur. That just what the internet did to the AT&T monopoly and the mainstream media's control of the narrative, that Bitcoin has the potential and is doing right now to the even worse, the more bloated and corrupt financial system that we are you're really stuck under with no alternative currently. Well, Bitcoin is the alternative now. Bitcoin is the first realistic alternative, the only way to ever really escape, to step outside of that and not participate. This is still, in my personal experience, this is really the most effective way to frame it for kind of the average curious person. I like to do, I like to tell them the story of how the internet, a lot of people kind of know, like, inherently that the internet has changed things, but have never really heard the story of the internet disrupting media, like how exactly it went through. And if you kind of break down that step by step, how it disrupted media, it disrupted retail, and, you know, give them examples that they saw in their life, like Blockbuster, Circuit City, and now the potentially Best Buy, how the news has kind of been turned on its head and has become just kind of a redundant, a parrot of the establishment, and has become fully redundant. Like, when I constantly go to, I very rarely go to the media, but when I do, almost inevitably, within a couple of minutes, they are showing a tweet on their screen and then talking about how this happened on Twitter, or this is being shared and going viral on Facebook, and giving their opinion on it. And I'm like, why do I was already on Facebook and Twitter. Why do I need you? And then how, you know, the media, like the cable news, Hollywood is even being threatened by this. Their scope of control over, like, the explosion of independent media in the last decade has been unparalleled in the history of film and just media in general. And the quality of that stuff has skyrocketed. There was never to find a high quality, high budget, incredibly well done, with known actors and directors, like people who knew their craft, series, like television series, mini series, like Netflix, like eight episode, like extended storylines that go on for years. That was unheard of 20 years ago. Unheard of. TV was sitcoms. That was it. The scope of media, and to think that we have the range all the way from your typical crappy YouTube video to the billions of things that get up to, you know, series of just podcast-like things that are just informational, that explore topics, that that tell fascinating short stories, and, you know, have millions of subscribers for that reason, or just entertain in 100 different ways. And then all the way up to these huge Game of Thrones series, to Stranger Things, all of these huge, incredibly well done series that are literally movies extended out to 8 hours. People forget how new that is. That didn't exist just a few years ago. And then the internet tore down the communications monopolies like AT&T. It's drastically changed the landscape of global trade. But the one place that it has yet to really tackle, the one major industry that has yet to really feel the scope of the internet's disruption, is the financial and monetary systems. And it is because they are so deeply embedded in the political system that they have essentially had this, there's this much larger barrier to the competition. There is to get any sort of change to start to unfold, it can't be a minor disruption. It can't be a minor solution. It has to be a massive disruptive shift. It has to be a paradigm shift. And that's what Bitcoin is. This is the internet finally taking on the global financial system and proving that it can be done better. And at the end of the story of the internet, there will be no market that escapes disruption by the digital realm. And Bitcoin is proving that even that which seems the greatest, it seems like the biggest mountain, the true Goliath to the internet's David, will not escape the grasp of the internet. That Everything is changing. Everything is changing. And it will still take decades. But, you know, this is what I truly believe. So, you know, when I go through this with some people, like sometimes if they don't want to go learn about it, that's fine. You know, I don't think, I'm not in any hurry here. Bitcoin isn't going anywhere. And I don't think it's quote unquote competition is anything to be concerned about. This is a slow and steady marathon, and people will come to it in their own time. This is not a sprint. I honestly believe that those who think it is a sprint will burn out and die very quickly. Bitcoin will still be here. It will still do its thing. It will continue to expand its transaction capacity, new layers with new features. It will build networks on top of it, and it will continue to be the most secure and verifiable finite monetary system on the planet. And everyone will find their way to it one way or the other. So if you ever find yourself promoting it and feeling like you sound like a salesman, just walk it back. Don't feel like you're in a rush. I know it's very easy to get passionate and super excited about it. But it's not a race. It's not a race. Give them a taste and let them find it. It's the only way people really learn anything anyway. You have to make the decision for yourself. It wasn't until, like, I took that leap for everything in my life. I can't tell you how many times somebody has told me to do this, to do this, to do this. This is valuable. This is what you should focus on. This is how you should change your routine or your process to be successful or blah, blah, blah. And I ignored it. I even agreed to be like, yeah, sure. But it wasn't until I finally made the decision for me that I said, let me figure this out. I'm going to fix this problem. And it's generally because not because somebody told me to do it, but because I heard something that just kind of made me think a little bit differently about something. It made me realize the picture that I was holding wasn't quite right. And maybe there was some truth to these other things that people were telling me. And, you know, the way to do that, the way to inspire that is, I think, just show how something connects to something that people already value. Don't tell them what they should value, particularly if it's something foreign and unfamiliar to them. Don't tell them that they should value this. Show them where it connects to something they are already passionate about, or that they already think is important, or that they see in their own lives. I don't know. That's just my thoughts on how to not sound like you're selling a pyramid scheme, since Bitcoin doesn't really get the benefit of the doubt there. But it seems, in my mind, as soon as you've learned anything about it, it's so blatantly obvious that it's not a pyramid scheme that it's hard. When I first saw this article, when Parker Lewis dropped this article for the first time, I saw how long it was. Like, I went and scrolled down it. I was like, holy crap, how does it take 45 pages, whatever this thing is, a long read, to explain that Bitcoin is not a pyramid scheme? And then I realized after reading through it, I was like, okay, it's like the first 15% of this work is explaining why it's not a pyramid scheme, and then the rest of it is explaining what it is, and sort of the fundamental value proposition or fundamental monetary characteristics that make it so clearly not, basically paint the opposing picture, is not just say, okay, well, yeah, it's not a pyramid scheme, but say what it is. And that's really where the heart of this article is. And I love this piece. Again, I've been super enjoying the entire Gradually Then Suddenly series. And this is another excellent, excellent addition to it. But the first little quote that I have is, Bitcoin's innovation is that it represents a superior form of money. But there are no future promises beyond being in possession of a digital bearer instrument. End quote. And that's a really key takeaway, is even if, particularly if you're trying to be salesman-y, or like someone has done that in the past and tried to say that, oh, it's going to skyrocket in value, is that there is no promise of that. It's the promise is that this is a digital bearer instrument and it is an excellent monetary unit. So if you can lay out that argument, then there is the potential for it to have immense value in the future because of what it's competing with. But you don't really get the benefit of that argument because the general, and Parker Lewis explains in this piece, the general ignorance around money, like to say that it is a superior form of money, people don't know what that means. People don't know what an inferior form of money is. So how could they judge how good of a money Bitcoin is in comparison to something they have no foundation for? You know, if I tell somebody that this store or restaurant sells really great sandwiches, like they know what a bad sandwich is. They've had a crappy sandwich and they've had a whole range of sandwiches their entire life. They know what a sandwich is. So they can relate to that. Unfortunately, we don't really get that shortcut when we explain that Bitcoin is a better form of money. And you basically need an incredibly long article like this one by Parker Lewis to really break down what that means and why it's actually important. So hopefully they listen to the Crypto Economy podcast and they can get the short-ish or at least easier to consume version of that. All right, another quote here. The supply of Bitcoin and its rigid supply constraint is the foundation of Bitcoin's utility and fundamental demand. It is also why Bitcoin is not a pyramid scheme. There will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin. That is Bitcoin's shelling point. Everyone knows it. Everyone remembers it. Everyone can also verify it at any point in time. End quote. Now, this is something that I absolutely love and is such a profound aspect of Bitcoin is how simple the supply schedule is. Even without knowing, even with only a very cursory knowledge of code and programming, you can pretty much verify for yourself that Bitcoin does in fact have a halving schedule and that it follows what, like a friend in the Bitcoin, the Raleigh Bitcoin podcast group, we have like, I don't know, I guess there's like 20 or 30 people in there who are in and out of the Raleigh Bitcoin crew every so often. And we have ongoing discussions there. And it just came up again recently that somebody posted, they said, you know, look at this. Like, and they posted the code of the halving schedule, of the supply schedule. And it's like 15 lines or something. Like it's really short. And you can look at it and it's a basic if then sort of thing. And a math equation from setting a couple of variables, but you can really kind of look at, if you know your general math and you kind of know the format of programming, not that you're a programmer and you know the ins and outs and can write Bitcoin code from scratch. Like, you don't have to do that. Like, I don't know how to do that, but I know code well enough that I can get a general sense of what's going on in that code. And I can basically see, it's like, okay, every 210,000 blocks, this thing's cut in half, and that's the supply schedule, and that's pretty profound that everyone can verify it that easily. Like, for something that is so obscure to so many people, like programming and code, that just a basic knowledge of it is all that's needed to verify that Bitcoin is adhering to the supply schedule. And that you can do the math in your head. We talked about this in the Raleigh Bitcoin podcast a couple of times. But when you check a block in a block explorer or something, or you check a block on your own node, is that the reason why it makes sense, or possibly one of the reasons that Satoshi made it a halving schedule that cut every 4 years, is that there's no ambiguity. You don't have to do a math problem really to figure it out. Like, if you know there's going to be, you know, 25 Bitcoin this block, and then the halving comes, well, clearly the next ones should have 12.5. And then it should have 12.5 for 4 years running. You don't have to go in and do the math. Like, if it was a tapering schedule that changed every single block height, well, then you would just kind of assume, it's like, okay, well, you know, those decimals look right. But you wouldn't really know. You wouldn't be able to verify it just at a glance. But you can do that with Bitcoin. And even though it leads to these sharp inflation drops, these sharp cuts in inflation, I still think that that might have been a really important decision for the, as Parker Lewis talks about in this article numerous times, is the integrity of the monetary schedule, is the fact that you, every single block that comes in, you don't have to do anything. I don't have to break out the code again or a calculator. I can just look 12.5 Bitcoin. That's what happened. Okay, that's what was created. We're still in this halving schedule. I can check it every 10 minutes. And that actually leads me to a quote that I had way, way, way down in the list, but I think it's just, this is the perfect place to bring it up, was a quote, "A fixed supply is of little meaning without the credibility of its enforcement. Anyone can copy Bitcoin's architecture and code base, but what cannot be replicated is the credibility of its monetary properties," end quote. And this is what things like Ethereum and all of these altcoins and the plethora, the thousands of altcoins and shitcoins do not understand. Like, I'm constantly told that Ethereum is governed by the same rule, the same exact rules, except that its monetary policy has already changed multiple times, and it is set to change again in the future. And there seems to be no consensus on exactly what it should be. It's just, I'm constantly told the idea that quote-unquote minimum viable inflation, end quote, is their monetary policy. What the hell does that mean? That's the most subjective thing I've ever heard. That's, you could make the exact same argument that that is exactly what the Fed's policy is. And that is not anywhere near the monetary credibility of Bitcoin, of the Bitcoin system, of the Bitcoin monetary schedule. They could not be further from each other in that context. Okay, so the bulk of this article is really kind of explaining why a completely finite, like a perfectly inelastic supply of a monetary unit is actually the best system. It would undoubtedly create the most accurate and useful price system in comparison to something like the dollar. So a lot of this is based on really explaining where the flaws and the theoretical failures of the dollar and the central banking system, like what the heart of that really is. Here's another quote that I just really love this analogy. Quote, "The unpredictable changes in the supply of dollars is not merely akin to shifting the proverbial goalposts. Instead, it is more similar to building the field on a 1980s style waterbed and then shifting the goalposts. The whole game is distorted, not just the endpoints," end quote. Now, I love how this analogy could kind of enlighten to how putting monetary pressure in one location or in one market can disrupt, it will cause distortions that ripple through the economy and affect others, affect other industries, other markets, ruin other sustainable business by manipulating the entire game rather than actually competing on a core set of rules. So think of the loss of wealth and productivity that's caused by something like that, by like the game of economics, like the game of being economically productive is a game of how do we produce the most value to other people? Like, that's the point of the game. And to be good at the game, to be wealthy, to acquire a lot of wealth is to, in a voluntary free market where you are freely trading with people rather than stealing or lying or defrauding other people. The success of that game is in providing the most value, is in being the most productive. So I actually want to come back to this concept. So kind of hold that in your mind, and we'll come back to that in just a second, because there's another quote that really kind of sheds a lot of light on this. We'll move on to, he kind of goes into the price system and why a finite monetary system is so much more important. And now he actually, it was kind of around this section that he mentions Everyone is a Scammer by Bitstein or Michael Goldstein. So I will link to that in the show notes. So we have that one in audio. If you have not listened to it, you can actually already also find it. You can find the audio version both on my show, but it's also actually been published on the Noted podcast, on Bitstein and Pierre Richard's podcast. So it's out there, and you know you can find it. But I'll link to the episode in the show notes so you can listen to it if you have not. It is definitely a essential read of the Bitcoin space. But Parker Lewis does a great job of breaking down what the value of the price system is, what the job of money is, what its utility is that no other good can provide, why a money is a money rather than just some other consumable good in the market. Like when something becomes a money, what does that mean? What does that mean that that good does? What's the role of that in the economy? So, quote, money is used to communicate the relative value of other goods and services, and changes in the money supply distort the communication of this information by introducing an extraneous variable to the equation. End quote. This is why it is a good thing that Bitcoin has no other purpose than its use in exchange and holding value across time. A great piece, another one I'll link to in the show notes. Bitcoin has no intrinsic value, and that's great, or that's a good thing, or something like that. I can't remember exactly the title, but it's by Connor Brown, and it is a wonderful article breaking down this concept. But what it means is that the ability for money to give us accurate information is explicitly in its inability to take into account any other information about itself. If its supply is changing, well, then it can tell us relative value between a banana and a portable speaker, only with the caveat that it is also giving us information about how much its inflation schedule is, how much new supply of money came into the market. So if there is no new supply, well, then it's actually giving us an accurate view of how to compare the banana to the portable speaker, which otherwise could not be further further away from each other as consumer products. They're from totally different parts of the world. They're separate industries. Their production processes look nothing alike. Their capital goods that go into them are different. All the ingredients, the separate workforces, all of this. Despite this incredible disconnect between all of the things that go into growing a banana and all of the things that go into making a portable speaker, we can weigh them in value against each other because of their price in an independent constant. So the more stable that monetary good is, the more accurate that, 50 cent for a pound of bananas relative to the $30 speaker is. And therefore, the more accurate my choices, all of our choices, would be in accounting for the supply and demand of the entire structure of production and the entire scope of all consumer goods. This is why when Peter Schiff is constantly talking about how, oh, gold can be used in electronics and gold can be used for jewelry and all these other great things that give it intrinsic value, all I can think is that makes it a shittier money. That means that if for some reason this year, the desire to have jewelry, to have gold jewelry, doubles, well, then that manipulates the ability for gold to be a good standard to compare the banana and the speaker. Or in the example, Parker Lewis probably has a less ridiculous example of an iPhone and a barrel of oil. I'll actually just go ahead and read that quote because he does a really good job of kind of breaking down the same concept. But quote, if the money supply increased by 10%, and I'll just do a caveat, or if the value of some other use of that good, let's go back to gold. If the value of its use as or in electronic devices increases by 10%, The same problem applies here, but back to it. So if the money supply increased by 10% and prices adjusted equally, an iPhone would cost $1,100 and a barrel of oil would cost $55. This is the original being $1,050. An iPhone would still cost 20 times more than a barrel of oil. And that is the relevant information with which all market participants rely upon. In the real world, the problem is that prices do not adjust equally as the money supply changes. Instead, price signals become distorted. End quote. So, what's he kind of getting at here? It takes an incredibly long time and millions of transactions across the various industries and production trees. Like, just like I said that the banana and the portable speaker do not share the same production trees or the same workers or anything, if new money comes into the portable speaker industry, it takes a very long time to find its way into the banana production tree. So the banana does not adjust in price as quickly as the portable speaker. It takes an incredible amount of time before that new money supply finds an equilibrium relationship across all production trees, across all markets and industries. So the person who gets the money immediately after its creation has significantly more purchasing power to remove resources to consume value out of the economy than the person who gets it after the 10,000th transaction. But worse is that the money creation doesn't happen quickly and then allow the economy to adjust over a long span of time. Money continues to flood in from many different aspects. So back to the waterbed football field example is it's as if the refs of the game are jumping up and down on the field and causing ripples throughout the game. And they're all standing in different positions and they're tripping up the quarterback even though they may have executed the perfect play and been incredibly skilled at the game. And before the water has a chance to calm down, more waves are being constantly added. So the game is never based on the skill of playing football, but on the skill of responding to and predicting the actions of the ref. This is how a free market around production and providing value gets manipulated to playing a game of political favors, lobbying, and lawsuits. The refs, which are supposed to have nothing to do with the game, they're supposed to keep the game running properly, become the most important factor in winning. So the players start to play the refs instead of football. This causes people to become wealthy for the wrong reasons, and people who never deserved it, never had the skills to play, get rich by becoming skilled at breaking the game in their favor. This is the inescapable moral hazard of a political monetary system. And they not only have unlimited money to do this with, but also every incentive to teach you, to report to you how necessary their authority is for making the game work properly, quote unquote. So when you bring up that the refs are manipulating the game, that they're jumping up and down on the field, they scream at you and whine and bitch and say, how would you have any game at all if it weren't for the refs? Everybody just be going crazy. It's like, well, no shit, but you're supposed to just be a ref. You know, when you think of the analogy like that, it's almost hard to blame people for playing the game like that when that's how it's designed. I mean, if learning how to play football isn't going to make you a winner in the sport of football, then why would you do it? Why wouldn't you learn how to, in our analogy here back to the Wall Street and the financial system, why wouldn't you do the lobbying thing? I mean, there was a piece, some sort of a research project that tried to break down exactly what the profitability of a dollar spent on lobbying was. And it was like 100,000 to 1 a ratio for cost to benefit for like the major companies. Like if you could spend $1 million, you have the potential of pulling out like $100 million or like $1 billion or something out of it. I can't remember exactly what the ratio was, but it was just absurd. Like any dollar spent on any other investment looks ridiculous when you get to that size of a company. So how could you possibly expect them to compete on that field when, you know, like back to the football thing, that if you spent 1,000 hours learning how to throw the football better, but someone spent 20 hours learning how to just watch the ref and know when the next ripple's going to come and play that instead. They beat you. Why would you waste your time learning how to throw a football? And in this economy, why would you waste your time figuring out how to be productive when buying a politician and lobbying is the easier route to wealth? It's like that's the game they were given. Can you fault them for learning how to play it? I mean, yeah, I can clearly see that it's immoral, but a lot of people can't. They don't see what's wrong with it. In fact, they're told that there's great justification for all of this, that it's an incredibly healthy and wonderful thing, that they're providing some great value, that the central bank, I mean, just like Parker Lewis says, I don't think the central bank is malicious. I think they think they're doing what saves the economy, that they legitimately think that they are providing a value and keeping unemployment low and, you know, boosting the economy every time that things start to look crappy. I don't know. It's just sometimes I wonder, like, it's so easy to play that these are the good guys and these are the evil guys, particularly in that sort of a context. But, you know, when the game is broken and it clearly rewards and incentivizes one thing, people are people, man. They will do what they are incentivized to do. Like, it's vastly more difficult. And when there's no incentive, when there's no push or reason to question what you're doing, when you're rewarded for it, when you're given prestige and authority and people clap and hail your name, like, at the successes and great things that you've brought about, why would you ever stop and ask if what you're doing is right or wrong? Clearly, it looks like what you're doing is right. I mean, all I can do is go back and compare it to my old self. Like, I didn't think, like, I believed something that was drastically different and held a lot of views that I now consider very immoral, that were really absurd and would push certain ideas that I think led to incredibly bad results and really bad incentives. But was I evil? Like, no, I don't think I was. I was stupid. I was ignorant. That's why the only solution, I think, is fixing the system. It's plugging the holes where these incentives are broken. And it's unbelievable that we have that potential with Bitcoin. And that so much of it is based on a broken price system, is on a broken economic foundation. That the underlying monetary system, the playing field itself, is unstable, and that we can actually fix that. Now, there's another quote that he actually puts in this article that is from The Use of Knowledge in Society. I don't know how many times I have recommended it on this show, because we did two episodes a good while back now, reading that entire piece by Hayek. The Use of Knowledge in Society is part one and part two. I will link to it in the show notes, and I will recommend once again, you better listen to that one. It's just amazing. But this is one of the best quotes from it. I love that Parker Lewis put that in here. But it's basically that it's more than a metaphor to call the price system a machinery for registering change. That it's sort of like a system of telecommunications that enables individual producers, that all the individual actors can just watch like a couple of points of data. Like an engineer watching the hands of a few dials was the analogy. To take the correct action in response to activities that they have no other information about. Screwing with the money supply is like changing the accuracy of those dials. So maybe it tells you you're traveling at 55 miles an hour, but for some reason you have to keep pressing the gas further to keep the gauge at 55 miles an hour, and in reality you're now going 70, but your gauge simply isn't telling you the truth anymore. That is what monetary manipulation does. And it gives the perceived effect of creating better employment temporarily. But the reality is it creates an unbelievable, the inevitable shock to employment, a vast correction that must take place. Whereas we would normally be letting off the gas pedal gradually as the gauge changed, instead, we finally get to a point where we're going 120, 130, and we go off the road because we can't make it around the turn. And that's what happens, is that we create these 10-year, multi-decade sometimes imbalances that have nowhere to go but a sharp, painful correction that ruins, that wastes years and years of people's lives investing in the wrong skills because it's part of a market that's unsustainable, hiring the wrong people, buying the wrong assets, investing in the wrong future. And then we get this sudden shock, this sudden dose of reality that informs us that we were wrong the whole time when we would have found that out in 6 months. We would have found that in a year. And instead, we prolonged it for decades. And we misallocated trillions of dollars in value that now must go on fire sale prices to get it back to where it's needed. Another good example, an episode actually, really kind of breaking down, or I tried to give a good analogy to break down the market distortion and kind of what these massive credit imbalances, particularly like in the housing markets in the early 2000s, like why does it happen this way? And what's a good analogy to kind of understand the thought process from how it happens? There's a episode, it's a guy's take. Something I think it's called A Story of Booms and Busts, if I'm not mistaken. It's a really fun analogy that I think that I've had a number of people say like explained it really well. So I highly recommend that one. I'll try to remember to I'll throw that in the show notes as well, so you can check that one out. But yeah, we're already 45 minutes into this. I still have a couple more quotes, but we've basically covered most of the points. So another huge thank you to Unchained Capital and Parker Lewis. As always, just never fails to deliver. I love these pieces, and I hope you guys enjoy them as much as I do, particularly when they end up producing an hour and 30 or 40 minute episode, whatever we ended up with here today. Thank you guys so much for listening. Oh, and for anybody who is interested in sponsoring the show, don't forget to reach out to me at sponsor@thecryptoeconomy.com. I truly enjoyed Anchor sponsorship, but it pays like hardly anything. It's just kind of a filler. I really think there's a missed opportunity here, and I've just not really done the due diligence to reach out to people. So I figured I'd start, going hard at doing exactly that. And the best place to start is just kind of see who's listening to the show. So, if you would like to take advantage of that, like I said, we're right around the corner from 500,000 downloads. That's really exciting. So, shoot me an email at sponsor@thecryptoeconomy.com if you're interested. I'd love to start a conversation about it. All right, guys. And lastly, to the people who are sponsoring the show, my patrons, thank you, thank you, thank you. With 100% honesty, I probably would have given up on this. Because, I mean, it's great to have a lot of listeners, but those listeners are numbers to me. But my patrons are people who have put up money, even, you know, a dollar a month to prove that I am providing value to them. And every time I think, damn it, I'm not going to get an episode out today, they are the ones that I'm worried about disappointing, because my listeners are like 33 people in my mind. It's the people that I've had conversations with, and like they're, you know, sharing out an episode or just telling me I did a good job with this one, or it sparks some sort of a debate and people start going head to head over something that I brought up. Like, I love that. Like, that just makes me think that, like, you know, people are listening and there's something real here. There's something valuable here. And I think that's a form of proof of work for me, that a proof of value, I guess you could say. And I wouldn't be here, I don't think, still, if it weren't for my patrons, because this doesn't pay a whole lot currently. So, thank you to all of those who have done that at patreon.com and have also donated by a Bitcoin or Lightning. I cannot say enough how much I appreciate it. And, you know, if you guys want to become patrons, you can go to patreon.com. Or if you want to join the Crypto Economy Crew Telegram, you can either do that or any sort of donation. Actually, I've just limited it strictly to donations so that, you know, it's people that I know have skin in the game and want to contribute to the conversation rather than spam the Telegram group. You know, if you donate by Bitcoin or Lightning, just shoot me a message. You know, show me the transaction or whatever. Because I know there are a lot of people who hate Patreon. So that's totally fair. I get it. It's just right now it's the best solution for the problem. All right. So this was a hell of an episode. Thank you guys so much for listening. I hope you made it all the way to the end here. And I don't think I've said this on the show, but in the last couple of weeks, the explosion of listeners has been pretty amazing. Looking really, really good. And I don't know who the hell is sharing this out exactly and where all these new listeners are coming from. But thank you to everyone who has. And of course, the one way you can always, always support this show is doing just that. Share it out with everybody you know in the Bitcoin and crypto economy space. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And I will see you all back here tomorrow with another episode of the Crypto Economy. Until then, I love you guys. Take it easy.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.